Sean, welcome to the show today. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about how you first got into telemedicine. What drew you to the field?
Yeah, I mean, getting into telehealth, most people don't like, oh, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to be a telehealth leader involved in telehealth. You know, it's interesting because everyone has their own stories of how they entered the industry. I was actually a respiratory therapist by background, so I spent, you know, years at the bedside, ICU, emergency medicine, and got involved in a lot of quality improvement initiatives and started getting into leadership roles within respiratory therapy that way. And then, you know, certain things happened around that time back in 2013, where the state of South Carolina was heavily investing in telehealth, and they put a lot of money into MUSC, Medical University of South Carolina, to really expand telehealth across the state, develop services, you know, that met the needs of the community. And when that funding came, it opened up a, you know, MUSC was already doing a lot of telehealth at that time, but it opened up a position of, hey, we need someone to be fully 100% dedicated administrative leader to be overseeing the day-to-day operations. And so they posted a position for a director of telehealth. I heard about it in a leadership, you know, type of town hall meeting. It was like on a Tuesday. And I remember I emailed that person who made the announcement that night, is saying like, am I, you know, would I meet the qualifications? What's the things here? And so try to find everything out. And I had worked well with her before, and she was like, yeah, you make a strong applicant. So one thing led to another. And, you know, when I went in that interview process, you know, I came with a full plan, full strategic plan, everything that, you know, I read everything I could possibly get my hands on about telehealth in South Carolina, because I knew that I was like, this, I cannot leave this process and not have this job. It was something that clicked immediately that I want to be involved with this. I want to be involved with using this technology to transform the way we deliver care.
So what was it about telemedicine that really drew you to it, that gave you that passion and that fire?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting from my side, you know, because, you know, a lot of times people, they get interested in telehealth because they're interested in technology. And I'm not necessarily like, I've never been a techie type of guy, you know, Star Wars fan when I was little, but yeah. You know, I'm not necessarily the techie side of things, but it was the quality improvement, process improvement. And I saw what telehealth was doing early on, in the early years of telehealth. And that's what my focus was on. It wasn't necessarily the technology. It was like, wow, like, you know, from an access standpoint of improving access. But I also realized, you know, we can use this technology to figure out new ways and how to deliver care, realizing that, you know, when I went through MHA school at MUSC, I just really understand like how inefficient the healthcare system is set up, how fragmented it's set up. And telehealth was something that, you know, I had a little bit, you know, I learned a little bit in MHA school. Now it's really broadened of what they're teaching there. And, you know, I love being even part of, you know, guest lecture, you know, when I come back and talk about that. But it was a little bit to introduce telehealth. And it was interesting, you know, when you think about, you know, improving quality, you know, cost, you know, access, all these different things. Typically, you know, I would always learn, well, if you improve access, you also increase cost. Or if you decrease cost, you're going to have a negative effect on quality and access, where telehealth early was something that, you know, if used correctly, appropriately, in right settings, you can actually have positive movements on all those. You can actually improve quality while simultaneously decreasing costs and improving access. And so like that, it was that process standpoint that drew me to telehealth more than anything.
So you're a respiratory therapist, you got MHA, so you're learning about all these things in healthcare. And when telemedicine came along, you saw this as an opportunity to solve a lot of those problems that exist in healthcare with this new technology that was just emerging back in the early 2010s.
Yeah, no, it was exciting to even have the opportunity to be a part of something like that. I loved patient care, and a lot of times people talk about, you know, was that hard for you to get out of patient care and do that transition? And I'll admit, I think that was something that there was a sacrifice there of like, I'm going to sacrifice these daily interactions with patients that I never met before. And they've got an awesome story, and you relate to them. You got old ladies asking you to hug them and stuff and different things like that. But it was a sacrifice on that, because I always had this like this vision, passion to affect larger populations.
Right.
And so that was like what really opened up. It's like, you know, I could do a big impact on, you know, South Carolina and really contribute to the movement that had already started. And there were so many pioneers in South Carolina that were doing a lot of great work. And just to be a part of that was, you know, something special.
Instead of, affecting one by one, you're really affecting a large population by this. So back in, you said it's 2013?
Yep.
So back in 2013, let's like jump back to take a time machine, go back there. What was it like doing telemedicine back then? What were some of the challenges that you faced? What were the things that people were talking about, thinking about back then? And what were you largely focused on back in then?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, we had a couple of focus. It was one, we were trying to get people in South Carolina working together in some strategic way. And so we did a lot of strategic planning, you know, with different groups that health systems across South Carolina, which eventually then started the South Carolina Telehealth Alliance. We developed the first strategic plan telehealth strategic plan for South Carolina back in 2014. But then the other big part was developing services that met the needs of the community. And, you know, that was tricky. You had a lot of technology infrastructure challenges. You would have a small hospital that had three big telehealth carts in their ER, and they had to think about which cart they grabbed to determine who they're supposed to call for whatever that service. If it was a telestroke, they call one person. If it's telesite, they call someone else. If it's cardiology, they got to call a third group. And so there was a lot of that, you know, the way we looked at it is like, you know, our job is not only to create services that are going to meet the, you know, needs of the communities, but we also need to identify and either break down or mitigate the barriers to adoption and utilization. And so, you know, keeping a pulse on the rural communities and those who are receiving a lot of the services, understanding like where are their pain points. And some of it is like, hey, I need this service developed and we don't have this specialty in anywhere in our, you know, county. So it's like, hey, going back to MUSC providers and say, let's work together to develop this service. But then also from the receiving end of the technology, the workflow, we knew that whatever we, you know, anything, people always talk about the disruption, you know, and anything you do, there's going to be disruption. There's a lot of change management that happens with the implementation of telehealth services, managing the, you know, the change management and key people involved in that with clinical champions and stuff like that. But really, you know, whatever we would deliver, put in place, one of our core things was it has to be equal to or better than what the staff is already doing right now. We can't say, because we realize how many stakeholders were involved. You can't say, hey, this is great for the patient, but we're going to ask the on-site nurse to do twice the amount of work.
Right.
Because that nurse may be extremely passionate about, you know, his or her patient population, but they also have limited time and capacity. So you got to figure out like all these different stakeholders. It's got to be either equal or better. It might be neutral, but it can't be worse. Same thing from like a payer perspective. You can't say, hey, you know, we're going to do all this great work, but it's going to cost the payers three times what it would have, right? Then it's never going to get reimbursement policy to back it. It's never going to be sustainable. So there's a lot of that, like trying to figure out all the different players and understand telehealth development implementation from their perspective to be able to succeed.
So do you have any war wounds from when you did try to roll something out and it was more complicated and you learned, gosh, I'm not going to do that again?
I mean, there was a lot of different things that I don't even know if I would say they got rolled out. It was more or less a lot of time and effort was invested in the planning and development, never to see it go anywhere or never to see it go anywhere for like a couple of years.
Right.
And some of that was around, and we started developing tools around this to help ourselves, you know, some lessons learned of, you know, you would get maybe an administrative leader, C-suite leader to say, hey, we got to develop this service. I need you to get it started right away, get it going. And we've got someone who wants the service, right? And so it's like, all right, you know, someone wants the service, leadership is saying develop it, we develop it, or we start to develop it, we start to get into planning. And then you find out, well, there's no clinical champion, you know, within this service line who's going to take this on to be able to lead it. And you can't develop a clinical service without a clinical champion. It's just not going to work, right? Or there would be one clinical champion identified, but it's supposed to be, you know, a 24-hour service, and that clinical champion doesn't have the buy-in from, you know, their peers, or there's just no clinical capacity. It's like, hey, we would love to do this. We can't take care of our patient workload right now. There's no way we can expand and take care of more. So it was, you know, a lot of those things of, you know, we need to really understand our own internal readiness. Like what are certain readiness things that we have to think about? You got to have a clinical champion. You got to have clinical capacity. You got to make sure that the service is aligning with organizational strategy, because, and it's not saying that you can't make movement on those things if they are weak in those areas. It's just saying that if you start checking those boxes, it increases your likelihood to expedite the development of the service. If you can align it with organizational strategy, now all of a sudden it's a priority of other departments, and then all of a sudden you can get the buy-in, because in telehealth you can't do anything alone, right? Yeah. You need legal assistance, you need procurement, you need compliance assistance, you need IT assistance, you need all these stakeholders, and you know, it becomes, the only time I've ever seen all of those aligned is during COVID. That's the only time when like you can just move everything forward because it was everyone's top priority.
Yeah.
In all normal, you know, periods of time, your priority is not everyone else's priority. And so you got to kind of figure those things out. But if you get strategic alignment, that definitely helps increase your odds.
What is the process that you found that's most effective in going and assessing if you have that strategic alignment and if everybody's on board? You just go and ask these people, or is there some type of assessment or framework that you use to measure this?
Yeah, well, so we've developed something called TSIM, the TSIM framework at MUSC, and it's something that's based off of our long lessons learned in telehealth development, implementation, and operations, leading back to when MUSC first started developing telehealth services back in 2005, you know, way before I even started. And it was just, it's been a way to structure, you know, the whole part from a telehealth idea all the way through operations in a phased approach to be able to break things down and have standardized processes, but then also understand where your weaknesses and vulnerabilities are. Mm-hmm. So then you can address them through continuous quality improvement. And so like early on in the strategy phase of that, you know, we had standardized processes where, all right, we would have a standardized intake form. So we're getting vital information, nothing more or nothing less than what's needed to be able to advance that service on for an assessment, a prioritization, you know, using tools to be able to prioritize things I talked about before. You know, is there a clinical champion? Is there clinical capacity? How does it align? What's the impact on cost, you know, quality and access? You know, what's the market opportunity for this service, the potential for it to grow? Is the market already saturated with this? You know, those types of things to be able to say, yes, this is a high priority. We need to make sure we put a lot of effort on it. And it was a lot of things also to help with workforce management to be able to say, hey, our high priority things, let's get 80% of our effort on those, you know, 20% of our effort, let's continue to mature some of these other ideas to move them, you know, make progress on them, knowing that they're not fully there, but over time, you know, we can start plugging the pieces together to get them to a point where we can implement and go live with them.
And you call it TSIM. What does TSIM stand for?
So originally, telehealth service implementation model. And and again, just to be able to really have a phased approach. So I kind of talked a little bit about the strategy phase where we're defining the scope of the service, you know, defining success metrics up front. You know, I see a lot of organizations, they go live and they're like, you know, now we're trying to figure out how we measure our success. When you got to identify those things up front. And you're thinking about the technology in the strategy phase, you know, so you at least have something directional of like, hey, this is going to be a real-time video encounter type of service, or this is going to be an asynchronous telehealth type of service. You have, and do we have the tools organizationally to meet that? Because then again, you don't want to say, hey, this is going to be an asynchronous service. You move it in development. It's like, well, we don't have that platform. We don't have technology that can do that, you know? So again, so at a high level, you're starting to think of those things. And then when you get into the development phase, it's very project management heavy, navigating components of clinical, technology, legal and regulatory, and outcomes, you know, all the things that say, you know, from a clinical workflow, mapping that out, and identifying ways of where could we make improvements. And so a lot of times, you know, when we've met with people in the past, you know, people see it as a way of like, hey, I do these 10 steps clinically. And so I'm thinking we could either replicate all 10 steps via telehealth, or maybe just steps 2 and 3 will be telehealth. Mm-hmm. And so we try to pause there in the strategy phase and say, like, what's the goals of the 10 steps? Like, what are you trying to achieve? I remember having a discussion with he was some type of neurologist, and he had these initial clinics to be able to say, you know, if the patient was a candidate for surgery or not. And he goes, so I have these clinics that take about like 15, 20 minutes. And, you know, so I just do them over video. I'm figuring I can just do them over video. How would we do this? And so we kind of talked through this with him. And I was like, so what, you know, what's the purpose of the process and what's your goal? He's like, well, I need to ask I always ask the patient these two questions, and then I'll make sure I get their head CT. And by that, then I can make a determination if they're, you know, a candidate for surgery. I'm like, so you need two questions answered from the patient, and then you need an image. So tell me again why you actually need to see this person either in person or via video. And he's like, well, I don't know, it's the way we always have done it, you know? And yeah. So to break that down, I'm like, so if you had this image and you got them asynchronously to answer these questions and you just saw that in a matter of 30 seconds, he goes, I could make a determination in 30 seconds. So I was like, so all of a sudden you took a 15, 20 minute clinic visit and you got that answer down into less than 30 seconds. And all of a sudden light bulbs are breaking. He's like, yeah. So we can do that. You know, it's like, and it starts to open up then the gateways open up, you know, of ideas like, well, if we can do that, what about this other thing? You know, and that's, I love seeing that from a clinician's, you know, viewpoint of when the gates of ideas open up, because it's unfortunately that a lot of our clinician champions, they've been raised in this way of, you do it this way because this is how you get paid.
Right.
And so that's why there's all these restrictions. Like, I do all these things, not because I need to, because that's how you get paid in the fee for service system. Right. And now that things are evolving more towards value based, you know, I think it's like 38, 40% of all payments are, it's some type of value based or bundled payment. You're starting to see that shift happen. I hope it speeds up over the next couple of years, but that way all of a sudden it gives providers tools of, hey, you're going to get paid for the care you deliver, use whatever tools and do it however you know, whatever makes the most sense.
So it sounds like with this example you shared, you sat down and you asked them the question, what are you trying to achieve? And, you know, provided some alternatives. Are there other tools and techniques you use when you talk to providers or administrators to get them on board with the concept of telemedicine?
Yeah, I mean, now I don't know about the concept. I mean, I think, you know, post COVID, I think everyone is okay with the concept. I think if anything, it's breaking free of the limitations of what people think is traditional telehealth, meaning like the video of what we're doing now, right? I mean, there's obviously a huge place for two-way audio, video, you know, telehealth, and everyone, you know, looks at like, that's it. But there's other elements of telehealth, you know, in regards, and people may define that in different ways in regards to remote patient monitoring, you know, patient reportable outcomes that are being sent, you know, via smartphone to inform the clinical care, asynchronous interactions, whether that's between patient and provider or provider and provider in regards to e-consults. So, you know, there's all these other elements and opportunities that we really haven't scratched the surface yet at full scale, which is, I think you'll see more of over the next decade.
And why is that? Why haven't we really taken advantage of everything that's available to us?
Yeah, I think it's just the way that telehealth has evolved, you know, in regards to it was clearly defined of, hey, we're going to have a big cart on one side that's going to do a video encounter, this point to point, you know, connection, you know, between, you know, either two providers or a patient provider, whatever that is. And that's been, I guess, the lens of how people view telehealth. I mean, when often even now when I speak to people like, oh, I'm in telehealth, it's like they just go to typically the smartphone pink eye thing, you know. So it's like, so that you just like, you're like curing pink eye across the world, or, you know, and they don't even. And then I start talking about all these different things telestroke, teleICU, you know, all these different avenues. And like, oh my gosh, I never even thought about that. Yeah, yeah, you know, and it starts to open people's eyes up of the possibility. So, you know, and again, it goes back to reimbursement too, right? So that was everyone's perspective. This is what telehealth is. And so that's where reimbursement has stayed. You know, reimbursements, typically it's video. We will not, you know, state, you'll see a lot of state reimbursement. We don't reimburse for asynchronous or other things. Now a lot of states are evolving from that. Some are evolving to pay for remote patient monitoring. CMS is paying for remote patient monitoring. So you're starting to see that happen now. But you know, the big, what everyone was seeing during COVID was, you know, hey, I did the two-way audio at home. It was great. It was convenient. But even most people don't fully understand the overall value of what telehealth, digital health, you know, can really do for our overall healthcare system.
Really, that potential that's out there. And even that telemedicine into the patient's home in 2013, were you guys even thinking about that then? Or what was telemedicine, what were you guys doing in telemedicine back in 2013 versus what we're doing today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, great question. And no, I mean, going into the homes was extremely limited. You know, most of the telehealth that was happening during that point was into hospitals, connecting hospitals, hospital triage decisions, getting into schools. School base was really starting to grow. You know, when I first started, there was a dozen school-based telehealth clinics, I think, at the time at MUSC. And when I left, it was over 100 clinics that were connected. So the only thing really that was happening in the home was there was some remote patient monitoring with diabetic patients that was, you know, being piloted in small, you know, pockets of...
And that's,
you know,
probably asynchronous, right? It was like, yeah, you upload something, you send it up, and not...
The they would get a glucose reading and maybe a blood pressure reading, and it would get uploaded. The technology was you know, definitely a phase one type of technology. We had a lot of patients that were living in rural areas that the only way they can upload, you know, their biometrics from a device was they had to go to the town McDonald's where there was some type of connectivity Wi-Fi and then upload, you know, their information from there. So it didn't upload daily. It might upload, you know, once a week when they got there. But then it allowed nurses and doctors to oversee those patients and make modifications to their medications to lower A1Cs. And now, you know, I know that team, the Center of Health Disparities, they're monitoring 500-600 patients at a time right now. So it's extremely impressive to see, you know, the growth over so many years. But, you know, they're ahead of a lot of other people in a lot of other states that still have a ways to go.
Now, as you started in 2013 there, and so you've been in telemedicine for a decade now, essentially. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen people make, either clinics or providers or administrators, organizations? What are some of the biggest mistakes that you've seen these groups make, and what were the consequences of them?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot. I've done some. I've contributed to some.
We all have. We all have.
Of my fair share. I mean, some of the best mistakes are your best learning. So, and I've always kind of kept that mentality. You know, I talked a little about the service side, but maybe the technology side is something that's, you know, been unique. I talked about how, you know, we would have small hospitals with like three different carts to call different groups, you know, and we try to do a lot of things of like, how do we get like maybe standard software that could be on any device that, you know, you didn't have to have, you can only use this software with this device. We were trying to get away from that and really create, you know, what we were calling an open access network, something that was secure, HIPAA compliant, but was open access, meaning that the software was secure, but you could use different devices, you can, you know, to be able to connect with it, and you know, we can open you up to that. So we try to push that, but you know, I saw a lot. It would be unfortunate, and I think anyone who's been in telehealth for close to a decade or more they know of what I'm talking about when I say this is, you know, there's a lot of federal grants out there to be able to get telehealth technologies. And, you know, so there's a story probably in every state for what I'm going to say right now, where there would be, a lot of vendors would come through and say, hey, they go to a rural site and say, hey, we can help you, you know, with that, you know, application, you know, and here's our equipment, you know, we're going to put in there. And it's like, you can get up to 50 telehealth carts. And at that time, these were like $30,000, $40,000, sometimes $50,000 carts. Now, you know, they're probably half that now, but still extremely expensive when you consider other more cost-effective endpoints. But you'd have these big grants, and they would get awarded, you know, by the federal government. It's like, here, you just got $1 million award to buy 20 carts, to buy 30 carts, or 40 carts, and they had the need. Like, so their application was completely honest and truthful. They had clinical, you know, needs, access challenges, and all these different things, underserved populations, but they often didn't come with a service, you know?
Yeah.
So what you'd have is you'd get this technology, and then all of a sudden people are calling around, hey, I just got all these carts and I don't know what to do with them. And can you send us a service? And it's 'cause like all the money was attached to the technology. There was no funding attached to people and developing the service. That's why South Carolina was unique. When they invested money, they made sure that there was money carved out so you can have clinical champions to be. They realized the investment on the people and the process that had to take place to actually get the services out there. But you didn't have that everywhere, and so there's so many stories that I've heard of either locally or across the country where, you know, you hear someone that says, yeah, you know, they got this federal grant, they got these carts, and it's like once a year someone from the government comes and has to check, hey, is this cart still there? And they go and they take them down to the closet, and it's like, yep, still here. It's like, all right, we checked our box. You know, grant did what it was supposed to. You know, you got funded, you got a cart, and you still have the cart, which is what my paper's supposed to show. And no service was created.
Or something. Yeah.
Yeah, no service was created. You just lost the full intention of what that funding really was for. You know, it's like it got trapped in this, hey, we didn't need to get equipment out there. And, you know, good intentions, poor execution. And, you know, so, you know, we try to do a lot in South Carolina with helping with those conversations. Like, hey, yeah, you want to put in for this grant funding? Great. More money to help, you know, expand the network, the better. But let's make sure that we've got a service matched up to it. So we would work, it might not be MUSC, we would work with other, you know, health systems. Like, hey, this small site in your area is looking to do this. Can you, you know, there I refer patients to you for that specialty. You got clinical capacity, a clinical champion, you could take this on and develop this service. And that's how we would start to expand some of that, you know, infrastructure of clinical service delivery throughout the state.
You know, one of the things that kind of stuck out to me, it's not just the technology, but you have to, you can't just invest just in the technology alone. You have to invest in the people and the process. Yeah. And you talked a little bit about that earlier with finding a clinical champion. You need somebody that's going to buy it. You can't just have just one either. You got to have enough buy-in. But when it comes to people and process, what are the most important aspects? You want to make sure that, hey, you get this money, you get this grant, you got to make sure to do these things.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. When you think about people, I think defining who your people, who your stakeholders are, you know, and, you know, in traditional delivery, you're thinking like the patient, the provider, and your payers. You know, it might be different. And even if you get money from a grant, you have to think your grant's going to go away. Your payers is your long-term sustainability plan. You know, unless you're trying to find something out of pocket, whatever, but typically that, you know, there's limitations to that. Right. So you're always going to have those three P's of patient, providers, and payers, and then having ability to have measurements on how you're either impacting them. So the user experience, you know, in regards to the patient, user experience, tap in on your providers, you know, are they happy with, you know, the way the service is working? I remember this use case, this was years ago, when there was a clinical provider, he was a clinical champion, phenomenal guy, and says, you know, I love telehealth. I'm reaching a patient population underserved that needs me, and my expertise that would never be able to access what I'm delivering. And, I would love to expand it to the rest of my colleagues because we can do more good, but it actually takes me twice as long to do the telehealth visit as it would if it was in person. And he's, but I don't mind because I'm helping people. And I'm like, well, that's great, but we can't get to scale. And again, I talked earlier about, you know, it's got to be either neutral or better, right? And so like you're saying it has a negative effect on the provider side of things. We have to improve that. It has to at least be equal to the amount of time you'd spend in person, if not even shorter, even better, because we will never be able to get it to scale. So, you know, you start to identify those things of like, hey, those are your stakeholders. And then again, when you get service into what we would call the operations phase, you know, service is live. We break things down into two big things around service delivery, management, service quality management, and then operational technology management. And so you have key metrics to be able to assess, you know, the operations of the service. The how's utilization? Is the utilization hitting desired targets or intended targets? You know, we would see a lot of times people develop teleservices like an IT project. They project manage it extremely well, and it gets to a go live, and it's like project's done, and they move on, and then people come back like a year later, and it's like, how come we're not doing any visits with that service? You know, they treat it like a finish line when it's really the starting point, if anything. So monitoring utilization versus expected utilization, monitoring those experience around there, monitoring a technical reliability. Is your platform continuously reliable? If your technology is continuously having failures, obviously that's going to impact your provider experience. It's going to impact your patient experience. And, you know, you lose a lot there. And we talked about like the people piece, making sure you've got good support around all of that. I used to always tell my team, our clinical champions do not expect that everything will go right, right? We're disrupting, you know, care in some way. We're also working with technology. It's going to have failures along the line. They don't expect everything to go along, you know, perfectly. But what they do expect is that we will have process and quick responses to address those incidents when they do occur, right? It can't be, hey, it's a failure, it's down. We're not really sure. We didn't expect it. It's like, hey, it's down. We know what it is. We've got our people working on it. We think it'll be resolved in the next 10 minutes. You got to have that level of response and to be able to build things up front. You know, we talk about infrastructure reliability and the technical investments that happen up front to make sure that you're proactive. So you're always going to have incidents, but you want to minimize those by making sure that, you know, you're doing the proper maintenance, you know, or proper maintenance is happening on the telehealth software. You might need redundancy. You might need to make sure you've tested all your connectivity in different areas. So you're setting yourself up for success. Success is never guaranteed, but you want to increase your odds as best as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Remove all the failure points that you can. When it comes to metrics, you've talked about measuring the user experience, quality, utilization. Are there any other key metrics that you find are really important or essential for a successful telemedicine service?
Yeah, and some of those get around, you know, process. We get around, you know, experience, utilization, technical reliability, quality of care, which might be like, what's the door to needle time? You know, what's the, you know, some of these impacts. I'll say this too. This is important when we think about metrics. I preach this to our, you know, my team now and everything, and we've done it in the past. Is I highly recommend, and we talk about this in TSIM, is a performance metric maturity model, meaning you set up short term, medium term, and long term goals, metrics to be able to measure yourself against as the program matures. And what I mean by that is I've seen telehealth services come up and say, hey, we're going to create this service and we're going to improve mortality rates. You know, less people will die. It's like, that's a fantastic goal. But it may take you years to be able to prove that. So you need to have something up front, right? Or I've seen people with like short-term process metrics with no real long-term vision or goals. So the team kind of spins for a while and they don't really know the direction they're heading. But if you can put, you know, short-term process metrics where you feel, hey, we can accomplish these, or at least we can measure these in the near future, you know, right away and then, you know, make some improvements on them. And then you got some medium term, you know, you start getting into your quality metrics. And then long term, you know, sometimes you get into your financial. So I used to always tell my team, I'm like, if we execute on these process metrics, the quality and financial metrics will fall in line in theory, right? In theory, if we do this, you know, we have great provider response time on an emergency service, and you know, we initiate and execute on those things. The expectation is the quality and financial things will fall in line. So I think that kind of helps people when they've got that North Star, but they know that they can achieve things along the line, so they see progress is being made as the service matures.
That's really insightful, and it makes a lot of sense. And what are some of the, as you've gone out and talked to different groups and they've set these up, what are some of those long-term goals that they are ultimately aspiring to, but may not be able to get in the first couple months, but ultimately, what are they trying to achieve?
Yeah, I think it depends on the type of service that's being delivered. And a long-term goal might be 2 to 3 years. It might be 5 years, depending on what you're trying to do, you know? And sometimes when we look at those long-term goals, they're typically, you're impacting a population, right? And so it might be, hey, some short-term goals is we're going to get this service out. And you may have some structural metrics, and too, I should say that too. Structural metrics are very helpful early on in telehealth development, meaning, you know, number of carts, number of sites, you know? So in theory, you're getting a presence in a location, right? So that's like the first step. That's a structural measure of growth. And then all of a sudden, all right, now we've got the presence. Now the process of utilization then follows after that. And you may be able to execute on certain things there. And then eventually it may be, you know, affecting a population. So telestroke is a great example, right? What was developed in South Carolina started off of, you know, before any type of telestroke, it was like less than 40% of the patient population had a 60-minute drive access to time-sensitive stroke care, right? And so that means if someone had a stroke in a certain geographical area, they had a certain zip code, they went to their local hospital, that local hospital may not even be carrying TPA, the only FDA-approved drug to be able to bust up if they had a clot, the type of ischemic stroke, as opposed to hemorrhagic, which would be a bleed. So depending on where you lived and where you had your stroke dictated your outcome, which could be death, it could be long rehab, you know, maybe lifelong rehab, you know, and things like that. Where with telestroke, the expansion of MUSC's system, the expansion of other health systems, we were able to get a point where everybody in the state, regardless of where you lived, was within a 60-minute drive of expert stroke care. So your hospital might not have a stroke expert that's sitting there, but they get connected to one within less than a couple minutes, and you're getting the same type of expert consultation that you would have received at the best academic health system in the state. So that's a long term, and that's just a good like kind of be able to visualize that's population impact. And that's the stuff that I signed up for when I originally went into this role, you know. Yeah.
And so, I mean, the telestroke service that was one of the great examples in the state of telemedicine success and still pointed to today. What was an example of being, you know, under 60-minute access to expert stroke care as a long-term goal? Along the way, what were some of the short and medium-term goals for that service that you guys used?
Yeah, door-to-needle time is a great one from a quality of care. Utilization, you know, making sure that we looked at utilization, make sure that there was good growth. We not just utilization, but what were their stroke volumes? You know, we had some patients. I hate to say this, there were some conversations with hospitals of like, what's your stroke volumes? Oh, we don't get stroke patients. And it's like, you do. You know, it's they were undetected, which is it was sad. You know that there was that gap. You know, but then we would look at things from a site level of that. And the door needle time was nice because we actually had time stamp metrics. So we'd be able to say, hey, there's this national goal to get, you know, door needle time, you know, under 60 minutes. And it was like, all right, let's get it under 45 minutes. And so there was this constant trying to improvement where, it's, you know, we'd go to a site and it would be like 130 minutes. All right, an hour and 30 minutes. And then we'd get them down to 70. We'd get them to 60. We'd get them to 45. We continually to improve their overall process. And we had it timestamped along the way. And we would be able to match them actually with peers across the state. We say, hey, you know, we looked at your metrics. Your door needle time is long. And what we're finding is the point between the door and the initial order or the door and the CT scan. Like there was different points along that on that way where their time was higher, significantly higher compared to their peers. And we would say, hey, we got another hospital when your peers, you know, down the road, an hour away, they do really good with this. They got a great process. And they're like, can we talk with them? And then we'd make that connection. And so all of a sudden you started having this collaboration happen across the state, which would have never happened under a traditional model. And that's another thing that which, you know, I've loved about telehealth that, I probably under, I don't know if I underestimated, I didn't really look at that side of you of how much collaboration can happen in care when you've got, you know, people really trying to improve something, you know, for the overall, for the state, you know, the overall benefit. And so we saw a lot of that, which really kind of raised all boats in South Carolina as all these sites started getting better and better in their stroke times.
And just for those who are unfamiliar with door to needle time, can you define what that actually is?
Yeah. So it's a point when the patient's coming through the door and they still have to be fully assessed. Like, do they have a stroke? So they have to go through a CT scan and find out, is it a stroke? Is it a bleed, or is it a clot? And if it's a clot, there's a drug called TPA that is a, you know, bust up the clot, right? To open circulation back into the brain. And there's a time sensitivity on when you can give that drug. And so it's that point of like, once they enter the door to the time they actually got that drug, that the needle giving that medication. So it's a key national metric. So, you know, we looked at that, and in other service lines, we looked at other things, school-based telehealth. We had this long-term vision of reducing, asthmatic ER visits, you know, for children, trying to control their asthma. There's a lot of counties in South Carolina that did not even have a pediatrician. And so to be able to bring that level of expertise and control a child's asthma and educate them on their condition so they can be proactive and know when there's warning signs, know when there's triggers, in regards to maybe the environment that may make them susceptible to an asthmatic exacerbation. We found results that we were able to significantly drive down ER visits with the population in a rural location. So, but we weren't going to accomplish that overnight. And that probably took about 5 years before we actually saw the results, you know, the fruits of that labor. We thought that was happening. But until you have all that data and everything else proving it, again, a lot of process metrics of utilization experience leading up to that point.
Yeah, assuming you get the short medium term goals met, that's the only way you'll be able to get the long term goals met. And if you can't get those short and medium, there's no way to guarantee the long term.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you spent 8-9 years at MUSC. What are some things that you are particularly proud of in your time there, and what you were able to accomplish?
I'm proud of a lot of things. I mean, and just being a part of that was amazing to me. To be a part of that first telehealth strategic plan for the state of South Carolina, to be in the room with some of these people. And I'm not gonna lie, I was a little awestruck, you know, when I was in some of those rooms at first, coming from the respiratory department. My old medical director used to tell me when I first got that job, he's like, "Don't forget, you earned your seat at that table," you know? And I remember being in rooms at that table, quietly saying in my head, "I earned my place at this table. I earned my place at this table." Uh-huh. And, you know, and cause it was kind of surreal at first. And to see how difficult it can be to make progress when, let's be honest, there was health systems that were, there were competing health systems coming together, trying to figure out how to work together and move forward. We all had a very aligned interest in, we want to help our patient population of South Carolina. Like, we were aligned on that, you know, but then there was the underlying piece of the competition. And so there would be progress and then some steps back and always coming back of, where can we work together? Where can we make progress? So to see how the South Carolina Telehealth Alliance evolved and then eventually was awarded the President's Award by ATA a couple years ago for, you know, the transformation of healthcare delivery. Like, that was huge. That was just, and it was great validation on the collaboration that happened across our state. And in everything we did with the MUSC Center for Telehealth and developing our services and being able to not only expand services across the state in so many different key deliveries. I mean, we became nationally known for our breadth and depth of telehealth development and implementation. And then, you know, in 2017, when MUSC was recognized as one of two national telehealth centers of excellence in the country, again, it was great validation on the team's efforts. And there were so many people that contributed along the way to all of that. I remember one time, I tried to stress this point at a team meeting. There was an there was an award. It was something with, it was with Telestroke actually. And I said, I was like, I want all the people who've contributed to Telestroke, you know, and getting this award. I want them to stand up. And you had your normal players, right? You get your medical director, your Telestroke coordinator, you know, the clinicians that were on the stroke call pool. And I actually had to call people out. I was like, you worked on credentialing for how many stroke physicians across the state? Oh, I did. Well, stand up. You know, how about you? How many Telestroke contracts have you worked on in the last 2 years? I said, oh, a lot, Sean, a lot. Stand up, you know, and had to make sure people realize, like, you guys are, you might be behind the scenes and you might not get, you know, the award on stage when some of these things happen, but don't forget what you did to contribute to it, because everyone who came through the door of the MEOC Center for Telehealth significantly made contributions to be able to advance telehealth and access to care to our patients across South Carolina.
It's really incredible to look back and think where you started in 2013, which was just, hey, we're going to start a center and we need somebody. And you come in to just within a really short period of time from 2013 to 2017, being recognized as a national leader in telemedicine, and then continuing it on. And gosh, we haven't even talked about COVID yet, but, you know, going from where it was to where you took it and where it is now, it's truly incredible. And you've definitely left your stamp on the center in MUSC and really in telemedicine in general, because a lot of the stuff that MUSC is doing is being recognized as, hey, this is a good way to do it and helping other people learn from it. So just want to say kudos to you for that.
Appreciate it, man.